When Anya came to, she found herself lying on the couch in the library where they'd been celebrating shortly before, an ice pack resting across the side of her face and head.
You fell off the roof.
She turned slightly to see Mason sitting in a chair a short distance away, watching her.
Not my most graceful moment, apparently. Besides, it wasn't the roof, it was just the balcony. I'm guessing they got away?
Unfortunately, yes. My fault. I should have anticipated he would try something like this.
Before Anya could ask what he meant, John Davenport came through the door, flanked by two of Mason's security team. He hurried over to her side.
Are you all right?
I'm fine. Just sorry that I couldn't keep them from taking the journal.
Davenport waved his hand in dismissal and turned to face Mason.
Was it ransom?
The bastard even left you a note.
Mason handed over a small white card, like a thank you note. Davenport read it and then passed it on to Anya for a look. There was only one sentence written on it. May the best man win. And we both know who that is.
Catter is going to be okay. They hit him with enough trank to put down a rhino, but the doc says the only damage will be a massive hangover. Davis, unfortunately, is dead. We think they messed up his trank dose and had to take him out when they realized that he was going to warn us about the assault.
And the enemy forces?
Not sure. We found blood trails in the trees and evidence that we might have tagged one or two of them, but we can't be sure. They apparently had vehicles waiting for them a bit farther down the street and hightailed it out of here once they'd gotten what they came for.
Which was the journal?
Yes, sir. Nothing else seems to be missing.
Oh, that son of a bitch.
My sentiments exactly. Though right about now, I'm feeling the same way about you.
What?
What were you told to do when the alarm sounded?
Well, I...
Go to the safe room, right?
But... Anya didn't.
This isn't about Anya. No offense.
None taken.
I told you to go to the safe room. I ordered Watkins to accompany you there and to keep you safe. By ignoring that order, you put not only his, but your own life at risk.
Well, yes, but I didn't think...
Exactly. You didn't think. And now Watkins is dead because of it.
The two men stared at each other, with Anya looking back and forth between them as if watching a tennis match. At last, Davenport mustered his dignity and looked Mason in the eye.
Oh, I'm sorry. You are entirely correct, and it won't happen again.
Damn right it won't.
Mason turned away, his anger spent, and the tension slowly eased out of the room.
Okay, time for somebody to bring me up to speed. Who is this guy Ransom?
Oh, Trevor Ransom is a low-life thug who happened to strike it rich during the dot-com boom of the 1990s. Unfortunately, he also happens to be my ex-business partner.
He went on to explain how the two of them had been involved in a series of commercial development projects early in their careers that had been extremely lucrative, but that had also exposed Ransom's true nature. When Davenport had discovered that Ransom had been using substandard building materials and bilking the clients for the difference, he'd severed the relationship. Ransom, however, hadn't been happy with that result, and the two had been bitter competitors ever since. They'd spent the past 10 years fighting over everything from mineral rights in Siberia to a chain of grocery stores in Birdseye, Pennsylvania. More often than not, Davenport came out on top, which only served to fuel Ransom's rivalry. Somehow, Ransom had learned about the journal and decided to take matters into his own hands, literally. The information put a whole new light on what had happened to Anya that morning and provided one possible way for Ransom to have known about the journal. Anya told them about the feeling she'd had that morning, that certain sense that someone had been in her room while she was out on her run. At the time, she'd thought it was just the hotel staff, but now she wasn't so sure. If Ransom's men had bugged her room or even put a listening device on her clothing, all they would have had to do was eavesdrop on her conversations all day to discover what she and Davenport were up to.
So what do we do now? Wait for the cops to get the journal back?
The cops are next to useless around here. Ransom bought them all off years ago. Why do you think we maintain our own security force? We'll just have to handle this problem ourselves.
You can't be serious. What are you going to do? Stage a raid of your own and try to take it back again?
Davenport smiled, and this time there was definitely something predatory about it.
Actually, We don't need the journal at all. Ransom can have it, for all I care. We already have everything we need right here.
Anya must still have been groggy from her fall, for it took her a moment or two to figure out what he meant.
We don't need the actual journal. We've got the whole thing imaged on my laptop.
Right. And without that, Ransom will have to find and then translate the coded message buried in the text in order to avoid going on a wild goose chase, which I don't think he's smart enough to do.
But they all decided that they weren't going to bet on it. Afraid that Ransom might somehow uncover the secret of the journal if they waited several more months before setting out as originally planned, Davenport ordered the preparations to begin immediately. Anya would continue her examination of the code, while Mason made all the necessary travel arrangements to get them overseas and in country. He would assemble the team on the other end and arrange for local support once they arrived on site. The accelerated time frame meant that they would be arriving in Mongolia at the end of autumn, necessitating that they travel fast and light if they hoped to achieve anything of value before winter set in. There was a lot to get organized and little time to do it. Despite the exertion of the afternoon, their conversation went long into the night. In a secure location on the other side of town, Trevor Ransom paced impatiently back and forth in front of the fireplace, waiting for his operative to arrive. The snatch and grab had gone smoothly enough, he'd heard. The loss of two of his men was a small price to pay for the artifact that they recovered from Davenport's estate, especially if it contained what he suspected it might. Hell, he'd gladly trade several more lives if that's what it took to secure what he was after. It was simply a question of economics. Which side of the equation was more valuable? And he came down on the side of the artifact every single time. Men were expendable. The artifact was not. He'd known Davenport was onto something important, but he hadn't realized just how important until he'd discovered that his old partner had hired that Creed woman. His research had shown that despite her job working as the host of that ridiculous television show, Monster Chaser, Monster Hunter, whatever it was called, she'd been involved in some of the most astonishing finds in recent years and was regarded as one of the top up-and-coming authorities on the intersection of ancient legend and archaeological fact. Her presence in Davenport's home could only mean one thing. Davenport had found Curran's journal. The bastard had actually achieved the goal he'd set all those years ago, which, of course, meant that Ransom had no choice but to take it from him.
Come in.
Ransom turned to face the door as Santiago, the head of his security team, entered the room, a leather attaché case in one hand. Santiago extended the case.
We have it, sir.
Ransom snatched it from Santiago's outstretched hand and moved immediately to his desk.
Ah.
He drew out the small leather-bound book. He felt a strange thrill of excitement course through him as he held the object of Davenport's decades-long obsession in his hands. Ransom opened the journal and sat down at his desk, bending close to the page to be able to read the fine script. He knew his Italian was far from perfect, but it should be good enough to get the gist of what the journal contained. He would have the whole work translated later to be certain they hadn't missed anything vital. But for now, he'd just take a quick look for himself. After a moment, he sat back and stared at Santiago.
Is this some kind of joke?
Is something wrong, sir?
Wrong? Of course there's something wrong, you bloody idiot. The freaking thing is written in Latin.
Sir?
The book, you fool, the book. Curran's journal is written in Latin.
I see.
Unlike his former partner, Davenport, Ransom hadn't gone to Oxford. He was a product of the streets and his own hard work, and there wasn't much use for Latin when you're struggling to expand your territory and keep the scum around you from taking what you had fought so hard to gain for yourself. Ransom visibly calmed himself. It wasn't his lieutenant's fault. Santiago was a good man. He did what he was told without questioning everything, and that was hard to find in a man with his particular set of skills. No sense in taking it out on him. He waved a hand at Santiago, indicating that he wanted to be alone, and the other man lost no time in removing himself from the room. When he was gone, Ransom picked up the phone and dialed his secretary in his downtown office.
Marissa, I need you to find me someone who can translate medieval Latin, late 13th century or so, and I need them immediately. Standard non-disclosure agreement and the like. Call me when you have someone, please.
Ransom sat back and stared at the book on the desk in front of him.
Oh, just what secrets are you hiding?
Frustrated with how the day's events had turned out, Ransom got up and began to move about the room, pacing in order to try to burn off some of his nervous energy. He stopped in front of the unlit fireplace that dominated one wall of his office. There on the mantelpiece was a small, framed picture. It was a photograph of the two of them, he and Davenport, taken on the day they had signed their mutual partnership agreement. Things had gone pretty well, until a day a few years later when Davenport had discovered his little side operation. Ransom stared at the photo of the two of them together for some time, then smiled.
I've got you this time, you arrogant ass. And when I discover the location of the tomb before you, the world will remember Trevor Ransom's name forever. You'll end up being nothing more than a footnote while I bask in all the glory.
It took a day to make all the preparations, but once completed, they wasted no time in getting underway. The plan was to travel aboard Davenport's private jet to Moscow, at which point they would transfer to a local charter service that would fly them into Ulaanbaatar, the Mongolian capital. From there, they would travel by convoy into the interior, following the directions Anya had decoded from Curran's hidden message. After the raid, Mason had insisted that she either remain at the estate or, at the very least, change hotels and register under a different name. Anya had decided on the latter option. After doing so, she got a good night's sleep and was up early, ready for what the day would bring. She had a couple of hours before she had to meet Mason at the airport, and she spent part of that time reviewing her analysis of Curran's hidden message. The entire expedition depended on a proper interpretation, and she was feeling unusually concerned that she'd get it right. After an hour's work, she still couldn't find anything wrong with her interpretation.
Only one way to find out. If we don't find anything at that first location, we'll know we're way off. Simple as that.
Anya next turned her attention to a less interesting but equally necessary task, researching Trevor Ransom's background. If he was going to be interfering in their expedition, she wanted to know what he was capable of. It didn't take her long to discover that he was capable of just about anything. Online media databases certainly hadn't cast him in a favorable light. Ruthless was a word used fairly often, as were uncaring, vain, determined, arrogant, and unkind. Ransom had had legal trouble with half a dozen of his development projects, but none of it resulted in any convictions. Witnesses disappeared or were bought off. Documents vanished. The pattern was clear. Ransom usually got what he wanted, and not always by the most ethical means. She'd only known Davenport a short time, but from what she knew of him, she couldn't imagine him doing business with a man like that. Their rivalry certainly seemed real enough, though, and Anya decided it wouldn't hurt to watch her back during the next few weeks as the search got underway. She put the laptop away and set about packing for the trip, laying her gear out on the bed first so that she could be sure she had everything she needed. While doing so, Anya picked up the phone and dialed her producer at Chasing History's Monsters, Doug Morrell.
Hi, Doug.
Who is this?
You know damn well who it is, Doug.
Well, I know that it sounds like Anya Creed, but it can't be Anya because she's down in South America getting me this incredible awesome story on Incan sacrifices to the moon god, right?
It's Mexico, Doug. I'm in Mexico. You know, that big country right below Texas? And it was the Aztecs who sacrificed people to the sun god, not the Incas.
Whatever. As long as the special effects department gets to reenact those sacrifices, I really don't care if they were carried out by aliens.
Anya recognized that sound as meaning he'd had an idea, and knew it couldn't possibly be good.
Wait a minute. That's it. We can do a story about how the Aztecs were visited by aliens who taught them... Damn! Forget it. I just remembered... We did that back in season 2.
Well, good thing, too, because there's no way you were going to get me to do a story like that. Besides, I've got something better for you. I'm headed to Mongolia.
Mongolia? Don't tell me. You're finally going to do that story about the abominable snowman I've been begging you for?
Not a chance, Doug. Besides, I said Mongolia, not Tibet.
Mongolia, Tibet, whatever. I can never keep all those Chinese provinces apart.
Mongolia isn't... Okay, never mind, Doug. I've got a lead on a story 10 times better than the abominable snowman. I actually might be on the trail of the tomb of Genghis Khan.
Genghis Khan? Isn't he the guy who impaled all those Turks on stakes?
No, that was Vlad Tepes.
You're killing me here, Anya.
I'm sure you'll survive. Besides, did I mention the curse?
Curse?
Okay, so it wasn't really a curse, per se, but she knew she could spin it well enough that he wouldn't notice the difference.
Legend has it that anyone who lays eyes on the Khan's tomb will die quickly and violently, just like the burial party.
What happened to the burial party?
They were ambushed after the burial and slaughtered to the last man. 60 trained Mongol warriors, part of Genghis Khan's elite honor guard. And then those who did the deed paid the same price so that no one would know just where the Khan was buried.
Anya told Doug about the journal and the clues it contained, but didn't mention anything about Davenport or the events at his villa in Mexico City. If she had, she'd never get Doug to pay for anything. It turned out to be a good strategy. By the time she hung up, she had Doug's approval for the trip, which meant Chasing History's monsters would pay her for the time she put in on the project, provided she came home with enough of a story to let them stitch together a solid show about the leader of the Mongol horde and the terrible curse attached to his tomb.
Not too shabby. Now all I have to do is find the tomb. Piece of cake, right?
Any luck with that message yet?
It would be an awfully short trip if I haven't, now wouldn't it?
Anya dug her laptop out of her backpack and booted it up, and then put the text of the hidden message she'd found in Curran's journal on the screen for everyone to see. Beneath the watchful gaze of the eternal blue heaven, the spirit of the warrior points the way to where the blood of the world intertwines, and the voice in the earth has its say. The 60 brides rode 60 steeds and now rest between the watchful eyes of those who came before. In their arms is the truth you seek, the way to all that was and more. Then climb to the place where Tengri and Ghazan meet. It is there that the Bator makes his home. Mason looked at the screen and then back at Anya.
I'm glad this makes sense to you, because I have to admit, it's all gibberish to me.
That makes two of us.
It actually makes a lot of sense once you look at it through the eyes of the Mongol warrior who dictated it to Curran, rather than through our own 21st century perspective. Beneath the watchful gaze of the eternal blue heaven, the spirit of the warrior points the way. Sounds like a bunch of foolishness to us, but to a Mongol in the 13th century, that's almost as good as MapQuest. The eternal blue heaven is another name for their chief deity, Koke Monke Tengri. The Mongolians had roughly 99 Tengri, or heavenly creatures, of which he was the highest, the creator of all things, visible and invisible. In essence, that entire first phrase is simply saying that their god sees all, and that he knows where the Khan rests. It is the second phrase in the pair that is the important one, and is our first real clue. The soul of a Mongol warrior did not exist inside the man's body, but in his solde.
Explain that again.
His solde, his spirit banner. The warrior would take strands of hair from his best stallions and tie them around the shaft of his favorite spear just below the blade. Each time he would make camp, he would stand the spear upright outside his gur, or tent. The hair was tossed about by the almost constant wind on the steppes, and in doing so, it soaked up the power of the sun, the wind, and the sky. This power from nature was then transferred to the owner of the solde, driving him onward, influencing his dreams, and helping him live out his destiny.
Anya looked at each of them to be certain they were following her explanation.
When a warrior died, it was said that he and his solde had become so intertwined that his spirit remained forever in the strands of horsehair.
So the first two lines of the message are telling us to find the solde of Genghis Khan, and that it will point us in the right direction.
Right.
How on earth are we going to find a spear that has been missing for 800 years?
We don't have to. We only have to find a spear that's been missing for a little over 70 years. And I've got a hunch that it never actually went missing at all. Genghis Khan had two different spirit banners, actually. One was made with the hairs from black horses for wartime, and one made with hairs from white horses for times of peace. The white one disappeared ages ago, but the black one was believed to be the repository of his soul and was cherished and protected by his descendants. Until the mid-1930s, it was safely stored in the Shank Monastery at the foot of the Shank Mountains.
What happened in the 1930s?
Communism. Stalin's thugs slaughtered more than 30,000 Buddhist monks and destroyed almost every temple in the country inside of just a few years' time. Legend has it that the Khan's Sulda was smuggled out of the monastery just before Stalin's troops arrived. It was supposedly hidden somewhere in Ulaanbaatar for a few years and then moved to another, more secret location. No one has seen it since.
But you think you can find it?
Anya knew it sounded a bit egotistical, but that's exactly what she thought.
Tell me this. If you were going to hide something that important, where would you put it?
Hopefully in the last place anyone would think to look.
Exactly. That is why our first stop is going to be Shank. I don't think Genghis Khan's Sulda ever left the monastery in the first place.
The other two digested that information for a few minutes.
Okay, let's say you are correct. We go to Shank, convince the monks to give up the Sulda, or at the very least, let us look at it. Then what?
Anya pointed at the computer screen.
We keep following the clues left to us by Father Curran. The second pairing of verses says we should search for the place where the blood of the world intertwines.
Blood of the world?
Yes, the blood of the world. To the Mongols, everything has its own spirits, including the earth. Remember, the Mongols saw rivers and streams as being the lifeblood of the living, breathing world, which is why they never bathed in them.
Mason examined the verse more closely.
So all we have to do is to find the intersection of the correct rivers, and then the earth has its say. What do you think that last bit is all about?
I'm not 100% sure yet. I'm still working on that. I'm hoping that the discovery of the Sulda will provide us with more information to decipher the rest of the clues. After all, the verse says it will point the way.
All right. So we start our search at Shank. Mason, is everything ready on the ground?
We've got travel permits and search visas good for at least a month. I've hired local guides to help us negotiate the terrain. Our gear has already been shipped to a warehouse in Ulaanbaatar, where we will pick it up, along with our transportation. The rest of the team will meet us there on the ground.
They spent some time going over the maps, familiarizing themselves with what lay between the capital and their destination, and then decided to get some sleep. Tomorrow was going to be a long day. Despite the fact that Ransom didn't have a translation of the journal in hand by mid-afternoon of the next day, he knew that he had to get out in front if he wanted to ultimately beat Davenport to the prize. Time was of the essence, and in a case like this, just a few hours could make all the difference. With that in mind, he ordered Santiago to go on ahead to their facility in Russia and begin the preparations they would need to carry out their own search for the tomb. Santiago was authorized to hire a team and to equip them as he saw fit. Transportation would have to be arranged as well. In keeping with their usual way of doing things, disposable assets were being used wherever possible, including the personnel. If they ended up having to cut and run, Ransom wanted no links back to his commercial operations. A hastily contrived accident would take care of all their problems, should it come to that. Confident that his man would handle things appropriately, Ransom went about making his own preparations for the journey. He called his executive assistant and had her cancel all of his appointments for the next 2 weeks, letting her know that he would be out of the country and unavailable. He then had her book a first-class seat on the next flight to Moscow. She had been trained well. She didn't ask questions. She simply agreed to do what he wanted. And he knew that it would get done, right to the letter of his instructions.
Oh, wouldn't it be nice if everyone was so efficient?
The flight was a bit bumpy, but otherwise uneventful. Santiago met Ransom upon landing and whisked him away to a private facility they had on the outskirts of the city. As they entered the grounds, Ransom reflected how convenient it had been in the past several years to have a place like this so close to all the turmoil, first in the Soviet Union itself, then in places like Chechnya, Afghanistan, and the Middle East. There was money to be made in turmoil, if you were willing and daring enough to go after it. Ransom had more than enough of both qualities. Santiago brought him to the central hangar, where the men selected to be part of the assault force were gearing up. Ransom ignored them. They were just tools, like any other, and he didn't need to get acquainted with any of them in order for the job to be carried out properly. He was, however, interested in the transportation Santiago had arranged. The Mil 8 HIP was a medium twin-turbine transport helicopter that could double as a gunship, one of the reasons he'd been attracted to it. The fact that it was currently used by more than 50 countries was the other. A quick paint job, a change of identification, and the aircraft, like any of the rest of his fleet, could disappear into the woodwork with a minimum of fuss. It was a useful trait, considering the kind of work he did in countries such as Somalia and Iraq. The Mil 8 had two fuel pods offset and mounted low on the body at the point just before it swept upward and tapered toward the rear. Santiago also had a Yakushev Borzov Yak-B 12.7mm remote-controlled Gatling gun mounted on the nose. The helicopter could climb at a rate of 30 feet per second and had a ceiling of just below 15,000 feet. The gunship's maximum range was just over 200 miles, hence the additional fuel pods. Santiago had already informed him that he was confident they could find additional fuel once in country, but Ransom believed in being prepared. The plan was a simple one. Wait until they knew just where Davenport's group was headed, then swoop in before the other team could get underway and grab the prize right out from under their noses.
Oh, the revenge will be sweet.
Satisfied with all he'd seen, he headed into the office to await the satellite call he was expecting. The flight into Mongolia was uneventful. Anya had been assigned to a window seat, and she used the opportunity to get a look at their destination from the air. It was the first time she'd seen Mongolia, and she wasn't certain what to expect. Ulaanbaatar turned out to be an industrial city of gray concrete box buildings mixed with brightly colored shops and multi-story modern commercial buildings. Factories belched smoke into the air, while settlements of the traditional round tents known as gurs lined the city all the way to the foot of the mountains. The plane banked, lining itself up with the runway, and Anya was treated to a surprising sight. There on the side of a nearby hill was a huge portrait of Genghis Khan himself, staring up at them, welcoming them to the capital city of the country that he had, for all effective purposes, brought into being. Anya took his presence as a good omen, and felt some of the tension she'd been experiencing since the attack on Davenport's estate ease. When the team disembarked, they found Jeffries, Mason's second in command, waiting for them at the gate. He led them through the terminal, out a side door, and onto a section of the runway itself. The air was cold, but not unbearable. Anya knew it would be far worse once they got up into the mountains, and she was suddenly glad for the cold weather gear that Mason had obtained for her before they left. Jeffries led them on foot about 300 yards east, almost to the edge of the airport, where the rest of their team was waiting with all the gear in a private hangar Jeffries had rented upon his earlier arrival. Just beyond, Anya could see the edge of an outdoor bazaar perched right next to the airport, and she was wondering idly if she'd have time to wander through it before they got underway, when Mason called the group together for a discussion inside the hangar. The team consisted of 11 individuals divided into three vehicles. The lead vehicle would carry one of the local guides, Nambai, and three members of Mason's security team, Jeffries, D'Angelo, and Kent. Anya, Mason, and Davenport were assigned to the middle vehicle. The third truck would hold Cook Bator, their other local guide, and the final three security team members, Harris, Williams, and Vale. Anya was introduced to each one of them at a time by Mason. Some, like Jeffries and Kent, she'd met at the Davenport estate. The others passed in a blur of faces and names. She did her best to lock each of them in her memory. D'Angelo, the dark-skinned Italian with the quick smile. Williams and Harris, the near-identical Brits with the thick accents and stoic demeanor. The fun-loving Vale. She was most interested in Nambai and Cook Bator, their guides. Nambai was a grizzled man in his late 60s, who Mason claimed had explored more of Mongolia than anyone else. He'd made multiple journeys into the restricted zone, even when it had been under Soviet control, and Anya knew he was going to be an invaluable member of the group. Kukbator, whom everyone almost instantly started calling Chuck due to their difficulty in pronouncing his name properly, turned out to be Nambai's grandson, a strong young man in his early 20s. Given what had happened at the Davenport estate, Anya wasn't surprised by the presence of the security team members, nor the fact that they would be traveling armed. What did surprise her was that she was the only one on the expedition, if you could call it that, with any formal archaeological training. She brought the issue up with Davenport.
Think of this as a reconnaissance mission. We're here to see if we can find the site in the first place. If we do, we'll bring in a full team and go over the place with a fine-tooth comb, but we have to find it first.
And we have to do it before Ransom does.
To that end, they had planned for quick movement and light travel. Helicopters were considered, but ultimately rejected, because their movements could be tracked too easily, and there was a chance they couldn't get the proper flight permits in time. Davenport wanted everything on the up and up. As a result, they went with four-wheel drive vehicles instead. The trucks were Russian UAZ 469s, four-wheel drive vehicles that looked like shorter versions of the Jeep Cherokee. They each held four passengers, with racks on the roof to carry the gear. Anya hadn't been impressed when she'd seen them, but Mason had assured her the simple design and lack of computerized parts made them the best vehicles for the steppes. Each of the trucks carried two spare tires and several cans of extra gasoline as added protection against their getting stranded far from civilization. They had enough food and water to keep them going for a week, if need be, though they fully expected to be able to trade with several of the nomadic communities they would pass through during their search. Each vehicle had a satellite phone, so they could communicate with one another without stopping. A large metal trunk had also been bolted to the inside of each of the vehicles, and when Anya peeked inside one, she found an assortment of weapons. Several handguns, a few assault rifles that she recognized as being HKMP-5 submachine guns, and the like. In the wake of Ransom's attack at the estate, Mason wasn't taking any chances. Considering how quickly this had come together, Anya was impressed with the attention to detail. She was even more impressed with the way Mason made certain each and every member of their small team knew where they were headed and what the rendezvous points were should they become separated at any time en route to their initial destination at Shank. It was clear Mason had led small group operations before. All that military training and attitude were hard to hide, even after a number of years in the private sector. Mason led the team the way an officer would lead a squad of special operations men on a mission in enemy territory, and it showed.
Where'd you serve?
Mason flicked a glance in her direction, then went back to watching as the extra gas was being strapped to the rear doors of the trucks.
Is it that obvious?
Yes.
I was 22nd SAS Regiment, British Special Forces.
Anya was fully aware the SAS were some of the best trained and most experienced Special Forces soldiers in the world. It made sense that if Davenport was going to hire someone to protect him, he would hire the best. Anya guessed that there had been more than one problem in the past. Otherwise, he probably would have been content with any of the half dozen or so security agencies that were typically used by the rich and powerful. She watched him for another few seconds, wondering where he had been and what he had done while in the service. Wondered what it was that made him leave it for civilian life. She'd come to enjoy his company over the past few days, and knew in other circumstances she might consider going beyond the working relationship they currently had between them. But since becoming heir apparent to Joan's mystical sword, she hadn't felt it was fair to drag anyone into a long-term relationship. Not when trouble seemed to find her at the drop of a hat. Still, Mason might be an interesting diversion for a while.
First things first, Anya. Maybe there'll be time for something else later. Right now, we have a tomb to find.
She turned away to tend to her own gear. 2 hours after their arrival in Ulaanbaatar, the team was almost ready to head out. The trucks had been checked, the supplies divided and loaded onto the appropriate vehicles, and Anya had taken time to review the maps herself just in case something drastic went wrong. But when it was time to leave, Mason wasn't anywhere to be found. Davenport was just about ready to send out Williams and Harris to search for him when Mason wandered back inside the door of the hangar, something bright red held in each hand.
"Where'd you go? We've been looking for you."
Mason grinned and tossed something in her direction. Anya caught it instinctively and looked down to see she was holding an ice-cold can of Coke.
"Last cold one for a while. After this, it's nothing but yak milk and warm water."
She had to admit, it certainly hit the spot. Mason finished his own soda in one long swallow and tossed the can in a nearby trash barrel.
"All right, enough lollygagging. Mount up. It's time to get this show on the road."
And with that, they were off. They quickly left the airport behind and headed west on the main road out of Ulaanbaatar. Slush lined the roadside, and here and there, unseen potholes made the driving difficult, forcing them to go slower than planned. At first, it seemed as if they would never leave the seemingly endless industrial areas and their thick coal-fueled smog behind as they followed the track for the Trans-Mongolian Railroad out of the city proper. But eventually, the factories slipped behind them, and they began to pass small villages and residential areas. Those of a more permanent status were farther back from the road, while the ones that were intended for a night, two at most, lined the immediate edges of the thoroughfare. On either side of the road, large herds of sheep, goats, and cows grazed idly, paying no attention to the cars moving past them, sometimes no more than half a dozen feet away. More than once, they were forced to stop or maneuver around an animal that had decided the middle of the road looked like a great spot to stand. The people they saw were friendly and seemed to be genuinely happy with their lot in life, at least as far as Anya could see. She knew the past few years had been hard for many of the locals. A harsh winter, followed by a long drought, had killed off a lot of livestock, and those who depended on the herds for their livelihood were still trying to recover what they had lost as a result. A few hours into the drive, they left even the smaller towns behind and found themselves on the famed Mongolian steppes. High rolling hills, covered by a carpet of dry grass, stared back at them wherever they looked, an endless sea of tan stretching away in all directions. Even the road took on a brown cast, as the pavement had run out long before, and the path beneath them was reduced to a large track of hard-packed earth. Anya knew it would look different in the springtime, full of color and life, but this late in the season, only the occasional herd of wild horses, one of Mongolia's national treasures, broke up the sameness of it all. With nothing to see and time to waste, Anya's thoughts returned to Mason. Seated in the passenger seat, she had plenty of time to watch him without being obvious about it. Her initial impression, that he was a good-looking man with a dangerous side, had certainly been confirmed during the past week, but she didn't have a problem with that. He drove, surely, confidently, just as he did everything else. Competence and a clear understanding and acknowledgement of their own abilities were things she prized in a man. She had to admit that Mason's past intrigued her, which was something she wouldn't have expected. She wanted to know more, to understand where he came from and what made him tick.
"What are you looking at?"
"Just imagining you spending your life herding goats like those locals back there."
"Me? A goat herd? You've got to be out of your mind. And again, a man can be induced to do anything if the reasons are right."
"All I know is, with the right clothes and some dirt in your hair, you'd fit right in."
"I don't get it."
"Get what?"
"Why, in heaven's name, anyone would want to live out here. I mean, just look at this place." "What? What, did I say something funny?"
Ransom kicked the flimsy wooden door open with one booted foot and strode inside the main hall, gun in hand. Behind him came Santiago and one of the local Mongolians that they had hired as an interpreter. Hundreds of candles lined the walls, casting a soft light across the room, allowing Ransom to see three rows of monks seated directly opposite the door, their orange robes a stark contrast against the dark wood and stone of the interior. An older monk in brown robes sat cross-legged in front of the others. His expression was noncommittal, despite Ransom's angry entrance.
We'll see how long you keep that peaceful expression if I don't get what I want.
Ransom knew he was 2 hours, maybe three at most, ahead of Davenport and his crew, and he had no intention of wasting any more time than was necessary. This man was going to give him what he wanted, one way or another. Ransom strode across the room and stopped directly in front of the older monk.
I've been told that you can provide me with the information about the location of the tomb of Genghis Khan.
The monk stared at Ransom's face for a long moment, then smiled. Ransom raised his arm slowly and put the barrel of his pistol directly against the gleaming skin of the older man's bald head.
I won't ask you again. You have 10 seconds to tell me what I want to know.
The old monk was as serene as ever. Ransom looked back over his shoulder at the thin-faced man who'd agreed to translate for him.
What are they saying? I asked you a question. If you prefer, I can shoot you instead.
They pray, asking forgiveness for any sins they have committed, and,
Now shut up!
Ransom decided that threatening the old man's life wasn't going to accomplish much. Abruptly, he shifted his aim to the head of the closest monk. Blood flew, splattering the face and robe of the man sitting next to the unfortunate victim.
You can either tell me what I want to know, or I will continue to kill your people one by one until you do. Your choice.
The old man didn't move. He didn't acknowledge the death of one of his students, didn't do anything but sit there, head bowed, praying aloud just like the others. Ransom aimed the pistol again. The results were the same.
Santiago, interrogate each and every one of them. If they know something about the tomb, I want to know it as well. And while you're doing that, have the rest of the men search the place. If it's here, I want it found.
Ransom stalked back outdoors and over to the helicopter. He climbed up into the co-pilot's seat and then made a call on his satellite phone. Some 7,000 miles away, the phone was answered on the first ring.
Marissa, do we have anything new with regard to the translation? And nothing with regard to the monastery? You're certain? Very well. Keep me informed.
He hung up the phone and leaned his head back against the seat behind him.
Just what are you up to, Davenport? What did Anya Cree discover in the text that my people can't? What did you expect to find here?
Ransom looked through the windshield at the destruction his men were causing all around him. He stayed like that, thinking, until Santiago came over 15 minutes later.
I'm sorry, sir. We did our best, but it doesn't look as though we're going to get any information out of them.
Ransom nodded to show that he'd heard, but didn't answer right away. He spent a minute or two looking around him, trying to figure out what he had missed, but there wasn't anything obvious.
Burn it. I don't want anything left for Davenport to search through.
What about the monks?
Kill them all.
The men in the lead vehicle saw the smoke first. Seconds later, the rest of them saw it as well. It drifted up into the sky in a thick column, ominously dark against the clear blue. A vast funeral pyre burned in the center of the compound, just in front of the steps leading to the main hall. The bodies of the monastery's former inhabitants could be seen in the midst of the vast flames, the occasional arm or leg jutting from the pile of wood and brush. Behind it, the once beautiful buildings had been vandalized so badly that in some places they were hardly recognizable. Planks and beams had been torn down to make the pyre. The smoke it gave off had stained the vibrant colors, the brilliant reds, the stately gold, the mossy green, dark with soot. The place looked dead. Nothing living moved in the ruins. Davenport stared through the windshield of their vehicle at the destruction in front of them.
Oh, Christ.
Anya knew exactly how he felt. Whoever had done this was absolutely ruthless. The unmistakable smell of burning flesh and hair permeated the air. Mason and Davenport got out of the vehicle and came up to stand beside Anya.
Think anyone made it out alive?
Only one way to find out.
Mason turned and signaled to his men in their trucks. The six security personnel quickly got out, drew their weapons, and headed into the complex to search for survivors and any trace of whoever had done this. Anya stood still, getting the feel of the place. Fear, pain, and sorrow washed over her, but she didn't get a sense that the killers still lurked in the ruins. She followed the others into what was left of the monastery compound. The first few buildings they encountered were small outer buildings that looked as if they had been used as meditation chambers or meeting places. It was hard to tell exactly, since many of them had been torched and only the ruined shells remained. The larger communal hall that served as the main meeting and meditation area still stood, though its walls were pockmarked with bullet holes and its door was partially smashed from its frame. It was toward this that Anya headed. She climbed the steps and went inside. It took her eyes a moment to adjust to the dim light. Once they had, she could see that the building consisted of one large room with a raised dais at the far end. Candles had once lined the walls, it seemed, but were now scattered across the floor. Blood stained the polished wood flooring in various places, and had even splashed across one of the Buddha statues that occupied the corners of the room. Anya walked to the center of the room, trying to piece together what had happened. The idea that blood had been shed in a place that devoted itself to serenity and compassion infuriated her almost as much as the death of the innocent monks did. She walked over to one bloodstain and reached out to touch it with the tip of her finger. It was still tacky, which meant it wasn't too old. A few hours at best was her guess, though she wasn't a trained forensic examiner and couldn't be certain. Anya whirled. A small dark form hurtled at her from across the room. She caught hold of his arm as his knife slid past her. A boy of no more than 10 or 12 stared up at her from a face stained with soot and fresh tears. He struggled to free himself, but grimaced in pain when Anya applied a bit more pressure to his wrist.
I'm not gonna hurt you.
Anya figured from the scared expression on his face that he didn't understand. She looked up to call for help, only to see Mason hurrying toward her from the front entrance with Nambai in tow.
We heard a scream. Are you all right?
I'm fine. Rambo here decided I made a good target.
Mason looked down at the boy she still held securely in the wrist lock.
Does he speak English?
Anya looked at the boy.
What's your name?
The youth stared at her with anger in his eyes.
Come on, we're not gonna hurt you. We're here to help.
Nambai stepped forward and spoke softly in Mongolian. The boy looked between them for a moment. The sound of a friendly voice speaking his language must have helped, for the boy quit struggling, and Anya was able to let go of his arm and help him sit up. Nambai and the boy spoke for a few moments.
He says his name is Chingbak, and he only recently came here as an apprentice to Master Daraduk. He says men came in a helicopter, questioned the lamas, and then tore apart the buildings looking for something. When they didn't find it, they questioned the lamas again, shooting them when they didn't like the answers.
Is Master Daraduk dead?
Anya watched the boy's eyes carefully while Nambai translated her question. The split-second hesitation before Chingbak nodded his head told her he was lying. Obviously, he didn't trust them. Not after what he had seen the other strangers do.
Tell him that if Master Daraduk isn't dead, we have a doctor and medicine with us, that we might be able to save his life if we get to him soon enough.
The boy stared at Anya after Nambai finished speaking, clearly weighing his options, then made up his mind. Getting to his feet, he led them off to one side of the compound, where he'd set up a makeshift shelter of partially burned timber and spare blankets. A solitary figure lay beneath it. At first, Anya thought the old monk was dead. He lay so still that it was almost impossible to see that he was breathing. The condition of his body didn't make it easy to look at him either. The material of his once brown robe seemed to have become part of his flesh, so badly was he burned. He moved his head slightly when she knelt beside him, however, and she knew he was clinging tentatively to life. She turned to call for the medical kit, but Mason lay his hand on her shoulder, and she understood the unspoken signal. As much as she hated to admit it, there was nothing they could do for the old man, something Mason had understood immediately upon seeing his condition. The small medical kit in the truck wouldn't even come close to dealing with his visible wounds, and they were more than 200 miles from the nearest hospital. The boy must have seen something in her face. He turned away abruptly, probably not wanting a woman to see his tears. As Anya turned back to the old man on the ground before her, his hand came up suddenly, grabbing hers, and she could feel the hard tautness of the tendons in his palm, where the fire had burned away his flesh. If the action caused him pain, he didn't give any sign of it. Instead, he pulled her downward toward his face. Anya turned her head, placing her ear close to his lips. He began to whisper to her in a strange, lilting, sing-song voice, in a language she didn't understand. But as he spoke, a picture began to form in her mind, an image of a long, slender object wrapped carefully in a red tanka, which was tied shut with silk cords. She could see it there, hanging before her mind's eye, and as he continued to speak, it began to grow more detailed, more solid, until she was almost convinced that she could reach out and take it from the thin air, just as she did with her sword. Through it all, he never let go of her hand. Eventually, the monk's voice faded away into silence. Anya pulled her head back so she could look at him. He stared up at her with an expression of peace and serenity on his face.
Go to the Buddha. Protect it.
His face went slack. Anya let his hand slip out of her own and placed it gently on his chest.
What was that all about?
Anya held up her hand in a gesture for silence. She shook her head, as if trying to dislodge something from it, then stood and walked away. Leaving the shelter and its grisly contents behind, she returned to the main hall and entered through the shattered front door. Once inside, she walked over to one of the four identical statues of the Buddha that stood in each corner of the room. This one had been defaced and riddled with bullets by Ransom's men, but they had apparently thought it was too heavy to move, for it still stood upright in its intended location. As if in a daze, Anya reached out and twisted its left arm just so. The statue tilted backward on the hinge built into the rear portion of its large rectangular base, revealing the dark square of an opening beneath its ponderous bulk. Anya grabbed one of the nearby candles and held it over the opening, revealing the set of well-worn steps leading downward into darkness. Without hesitation, she started down.
Anya, wait!
Behind her, Anya could hear Mason and Davenport scrambling to catch up, but she ignored them.
I do know, don't I? The dying lama showed me, somehow.
The stairs became a narrow corridor, running directly ahead for another 20 feet, before opening into a small room at the end. It wasn't much, just a 10-by-10 square foot room hewn out of the rock beneath the temple. A table made from a huge slab of marble stood against the back wall, as far from the door as possible. On it rested an ornate chest covered with gold and precious jewels that reflected the light from Anya's candle back at her in 1,000 refracted patterns. Davenport stepped up next to her.
Is that what we're looking for?
Anya nodded, not trusting herself to speak. As certain as she'd been that Curran's journal had been authentic, she expected that her hunch as to the present location of the Sulda would turn out to be as well. She didn't have to look inside to know it was in there. She could almost feel it. The chest was unlocked. Inside was the object she'd seen in her vision, a long, slender package wrapped in red cloth and tied with strips of silk. Anya lifted it out of the chest, laid it on the floor, and carefully untied the silk strips that held the bundle closed. Even after all this time, they were soft and supple, and Anya had no problem untying them. The red wrapping turned out to be a gorgeous tanka, one of the traditional decorated banners that were so much a part of Mongol culture in the past. Its surface was covered with images of the gods and with the many symbols that stood for eternity, long life, and good health. Inside the wrapping was a black sulda. Davenport was right. After being smuggled out of the monastery back in the 1930s, it must have been returned to its original hiding place. While the rest of the world was looking for it elsewhere, the Sulda was right under their noses all along. As she held the Solda up in the light, a slight breeze blew through the room, ruffling the long strands of horsehair that hung off the shaft of the spear just below the blade. For just a second, she thought she heard the distant sounds of battle, the thunder of hooves on the plain, the clash of bodies, the shouts of the victors, and the cries of the wounded. Then the room was still once more, and all she heard was their breathing in the small chamber. Apparently, Mason and Davenport hadn't noticed anything unusual, so Anya decided to keep what she had heard to herself.
Oh, I don't believe it! You did it, Anya!
Okay. We found the Solda. Now what?
The two men looked at her in surprise.
You don't know?
It's not like it comes with instructions, Mason.
Beneath the watchful gaze of the eternal blue heaven, the spirit of the warrior points the way. If the eternal blue heaven is the open sky above, and the spirit of the warrior is the Solda, as we've already decided, then, according to Karen, the spear should point us toward the next clue. Right?
Right.
So, which direction was it facing when we took it out of the chest?
Mason glanced at the chest, did some rough calculations based on where the room was situated with regard to the main hall above, and then pointed off to one side.
East.
Back toward Ulaanbaatar? That doesn't make sense. Genghis was a nomad through and through. The one city he did build, Karakorum, was built to house his treasury. He never spent much time there, and Ulaanbaatar didn't exist at all in his day. Besides that, why would his followers put his tomb in a place that was so far from what he considered home?
What do you propose we do? Put the spear on the floor and spin it around, then head off in whatever direction it lands?
I just think we should look around a bit more. It has to be here somewhere. The Lama wouldn't have sent us here if that wasn't the case.
Maybe he just wanted us to find and protect the Solda.
Mason started looking around, like the other two, checking the walls, the floor, even the ceiling, for hiding places or secret passages. When they struck out there, Davenport took the Solda and began going over it, inch by inch, while the other two turned their attention to the platform itself and the chest the Solda had been stored in. Anya and Mason searched the interior of the chest.
Hold still.
Mason, used to a lifetime of obeying urgent commands, froze immediately. Anya had a sudden vision of a blade flashing downward in the dark. She shook her head, dispatching the illusion. If this was a booby trap, if she wanted to prevent something deadly from happening to Mason, she needed to focus on the here and now. Mason's right hand was pressed against the inner surface of one end of the chest.
What did you do?
Nothing. I just pushed against the interior wall, trying to see if it was solid.
Anya brought the candle closer and peered at the area behind Mason's hand. A small section of the chest wall had shifted backward the slightest bit, which must have been the sound she heard. In the candlelight, the outline of a small rectangular opening was revealed.
Pull your hand away slowly.
Anya watched closely as he did so, ready to knock him out of the way if she saw any hint of movement from that section of the chest. But nothing shot out at them, and Mason was able to remove his hand without incident. Once he had, they could all see that he had inadvertently opened a small compartment built right into the side of the chest. Using the edge of his knife, Mason was able to slip the cover free, revealing the scrap of parchment that was hidden inside the cavity. Very carefully, he fished it out and then handed it to Davenport.
Why don't you do the honors?
Anya nearly laughed aloud when she saw how excited Davenport was. Anya and Mason crowded around him so they could see as he unfolded the small piece of parchment. The revelation, when it came, was a disappointment. Anya had been hoping for another stanza or two in the puzzle, another set of clues that could help her narrow down the directions to bring them to the second destination necessary to find the tomb. Instead, all they got was a few wavy lines that looked like lightning falling from the sky. They started at the same point and then spread outward away from one another from there. Above them was a triangular shape that could have represented everything from the Delta symbol to a visit by space aliens. While Davenport puzzled over the meaning of the drawing, Anya and Mason finished searching the rest of the chest. That took another 10 minutes, and ultimately proved fruitless, so they turned their attention to the spear itself, looking for markings or any kind of writing that might help them. They struck out there as well, just as Davenport had moments before. A glance at Mason's watch told them it would be dark soon, so they decided to wait until after their evening meal before making any decisions regarding what to do next. They placed the solda back inside the tanka and wrapped it all up, then carried it with them back to the surface, closing the entrance to the secret chamber behind them and exiting the building.